What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Oh, hey, listen up. We got JoJo from Jurors on the show today, so stick around. Meantime, if you're missing the Shadow Docket bonus show on our Patreon page, good Lord, you're missing a lot. Not only do we cover all the topics that don't fit into the free show, but the Shadow Docket is where all of our deepest, darkest secrets get revealed. In recent episodes, we played Jody Hamilton's incredible rendition of End of the World. We talked about real sex versus movie sex. We talked about our ADHD and so much more. Here's how you get the Shadow Docket. Just go right now to patreon.com/BobSeskaShow, sign up for the Shadow Docket level, $5 a month, and you're all set. It's that simple. Again, patreon.com/BobSeskaShow, and now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, March 6, 2024, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 1,142 of the Biden-Harris administration, 244 days until the 24 presidential election. You can find me on Threads and Instagram, The Bob Seska, Twitter, BobSeska_Go, Blue Sky, Bob Seska, Spoutable, Bob Seska, and our Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. So Joanne Carducci, a.k.a. JoJo from Jurors, returns to the podcast today. I'm recording this after the interview, so I can tell you this talk was a particularly fun one. Sometimes these things click, and today was one of those days. So you should definitely keep listening. We talked about Jo's portrayal on Saturday Night Live and her recent interview with Dave Foley from Kids in the Hall. We also talked about Super Tuesday, the Craven Republicans, the polls, and a whole lot more. Don't forget to follow Jo's podcast and her Substack. I got links in the description, as always. Meantime, don't forget to support this podcast by subscribing to us on Patreon, BobSeskaShow.com. Okay, here's my talk with the great JoJo from Jurors.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
My dog has picked now of all times to start barking. Ruby.
It's okay.
Oh my God. Literally just started barking the second I was like, oh my gosh, it's 1:30 and look at this thing. I don't know what they call them on dogs. Those big things that make them look like wolves that stick up in their back. And
oh yeah, their haunches. Is that it?
Like, I don't know. Is that a I never get the word right. She makes herself look 14 times bigger. I'm huge. It's a mailman.
So, I got to ask you right off the top.
Yeah.
Are you sick? Are you sick of talking about SNL? Can I ask you about Saturday Night Live?
You can totally ask me. My kids are hysterical because they're like, oh my God, she's going to talk about it again. They keep me.
They really say that. They're like, oh no.
Oh my God. They keep me in check. Like I was telling, I forget who it was, but the next day I was like still talking about it, obviously, because I was like, I'd stayed up until, I don't know, 4 a.m. talking to friends on the West Coast.
Yeah.
So my kids wake up, it's like 11:30. I'm still talking with friends about it. And then my son's like, you think you're going to make us breakfast anytime soon? And I was like, all right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because I'm a mom. Right. That's right. So, yeah, they don't give a and they don't give a crap. They don't care. I'll talk about it because my kids won't let me talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, you're so influential, but you can still make your kids breakfast. You're not above that, right? Pancakes, yeah. They're fine.
Well, I mean, I did call for the chef, but like he was busy, so it's fine. But yeah, no, I'm definitely not above making breakfast. I'm not above cleaning toilets and making breakfast, no matter what shows I'm on. Yeah.
Yeah, you should give Lauren Michaels a call. Don't I get a personal chef now?
Right.
I thought that was in the contract.
Is there Seriously. I mean,
did they give you any sort of heads up ahead of time that you were going to be portrayed on SNL?
No, and that's the weirdest thing, too. It's like, because then you're like, you know, people say your ears are ringing when people are talking about you. I'm going back in time, like, my ears, I don't remember my ears ringing all week. Like, Justin Timberlake just sang my name, ears ringing, but like, because they would have had to rehearse it. Nothing. I had no idea. Zero. In fact, it was so weird because it just so happens, I usually go to sleep kind of early, and the kids and I were up doing nothing. I was just going to start doing ab workouts because I'm a weirdo, and I was like, on my stupid pink workout mat, like at 12:15 in Brooklyn Dad Defiant. He sends me a text and he's like, I think I just saw your name in the closed captioning on SNL. And I was like, that's impossible. I'm in New Jersey. And he's like, no, your name is on SNL. And I was like, that's not possible. And then I'm so stupid. I'm like, your TV just knew that I was in your phone contacts and probably didn't understand what the Bee Gees were saying on the show. So it set, it just auto-filled it to my name. And he's like, that's not how closed captioning works.
And yeah, like, you know what? It's an historic thing because SNL has a long tradition of doing talk shows like that. I mean, going way back to, I think, like the 1980s, where they were doing McLaughlin group things where there's a crazy political round table, right?
Yeah.
And you and Ellie both had spots in that kind of prestigious setting. So, I mean, that's a big deal for certainly on SNL, but it's certainly for you as well.
So it's completely surreal. I mean, that's the thing is like, and then I'm like, because my life is, you know, it was the same. My life is normal. I'm a suburban mom. Like, my girlfriends know I drive all the kids in the neighborhood to school in the morning. I go to baseball games. I do all the regular stuff. My life is no changed from when it was, you know, a few years ago in most ways. So it was surreal because it was like, that doesn't make any sense. I'm just me. Just happening. Yeah.
Have you talked to Dakota Johnson yet?
You know, our people just can't seem to get it, you know, together, coordinated.
Oh, you've got people. You've got people working on it. Did Lauren Michaels supply people? Is that
no?
Is that
I wish. No, I wish. Like, honestly, I was so desperate to like be like, I feel like Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake like, at least owe me a drink. You know what I mean? It's like. They sang my name, and, like, I can't reach out to them. I've tagged them in a million posts, and it's, they're just, like, ghosting me now. I don't know. And Dakota Johnson's, like, not even on socials, so can't stalk her properly, unfortunately. No, I'm still waiting for that day when it's like, oh, my God, you played me on SNL. And she'll be like, yes, it was the best day of my life. It changed me forever. And I'm still waiting.
I mean, I remember getting mentioned out loud by Rachel Maddow one time. Well, I've never been on any of those shows, but one time she actually mentioned me because of a headline I wrote when the Affordable Care Act was being debated. And so that's something that's actually fueled me ever since then. I think it was, what, it was 2009. So it was a long time ago, 15 years ago. And I'm still like energized by that. And I wasn't even on. I was just mentioned. I can't even imagine
being on an established institution.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's like SNL's, it's a weird thing where it is surreal because it's like, it just sort of, I don't know how to explain it. It's just this other realm. But being on Maddow to me would be like the Holy Grail. Like, I don't think I would ever like wash my face again. Like, I don't even know. I would just be like, that's everything. I can die. I saw her once because I think she spends part of her summers up in Cape Cod in Provincetown. I think I'm not going to out her, you know, house or anything. I think she lives there some part of the year. And I saw her once walking down like the main street and I was just like, I would be your girlfriend. I'm not even a lesbian and I just want to be your girlfriend. So,
Well, she's certainly royalty, as is, you know, Lauren Michaels. And I keep thinking, you know, there were discussions inside the offices at SNL, certainly inside the writer's room, where they're like, do we want to go with JoJo from Jurors? Is this going to be the character? Maybe at the read through, Lauren Michaels is like, who is Joanne Carducci? Right. You know, it's like he's doing the Lauren Michaels thing and they're talking about you. It's not just being portrayed on the show. It's like you're inside the institution as a matter of discussion. And so that makes it even sweeter, doesn't it?
I mean, it just sort of adds to this like completely surreal component because that's what that like all the layers I had to try and unpack. Like eventually I got to that one because at first it was just like, holy blank. I don't know if I can swear. I can't remember if I can swear on here.
Oh, yes, but, you can absolutely swear.
Okay,
please
do. My kids will laugh. I was screaming, holy shit. That's all I could scream for. Like, and then I had this moment where I was like, I don't even know, it's an out of body experience where I went, oh no, I've died. Yeah. I'm dead. I've died. This is heaven. I must have died. died, because there's no way this could be real. And then eventually, maybe somewhere in the middle of Sunday or Monday, I was like, wait a minute, they know who I am. Wait a minute, why do they know who I am? And wait a minute, yeah. And it was like all these things. It was like, wait, they did have to have that conversation. And that was so weird. Again, I'm just, you know, I'm going to go to the shop, right? I'm going to be looking through the produce this afternoon. So really, my life is fabulous. Fabulous. Right. Yeah.
And the other thing was, they didn't bag on you. No. You weren't like relentlessly teased on the show. You were just portrayed as a person sitting there. You were portrayed as yourself. Yes. So that would have been the first thing that I would have been freaked out about. If someone had told me, oh my God, they just portrayed you on Saturday Night Live, I would scream first. And then I would go, oh, holy shit, I hope they didn't ridicule me. And they didn't, right?
Well, no, that's what's also really strange, too. And that's what a friend of mine, Mike Madrid, who was on the phone with practically until 5 in the morning, he lives in California, he was saying that, too. He's like, they didn't even destroy you. Is that what you expect? I mean, you know, they went after other people. And they, well, they certainly went after Yang. But no, in fact, it's so funny because I've obviously micro-analyzed it. And I was like, well, in fact, with the one thing they did have me start to say didn't sound stupid. I didn't get any words out, but it said, depending on which metrics you use. So that was kind of smart. And I was like, oh my God, they didn't make me look stupid. They didn't make me look like a caricature of myself. They even put me in like a cute shirt, and my hair has never been more on point. So I was like, I want to go get my hair done on SNL because, So yeah, no, that was also super weird. I was like, wait, they didn't destroy me. What does that mean? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you got to call the hair and makeup person at SNL and say, hey, what'd you do with my hair? I want to pick up on that. What's the technique? What's the process? Please tell.
She'll be like, or he'll be like, well, first you have to start with Dakota Johnson's head. Markedly improves the whole equation. Reverse time by 30 plus years, and then we can work from there. But yeah,
probably. Well, you know, I'm also jealous, Joe, that you got to interview Dave Foley from Kids in the Hall and Fargo season 5, by the way. I mean, how'd you make that connection?
Like, at some point in my life, I've just learned to kind of adopt this mantra. It's like, why not? What's the worst case scenario? What's the worst thing that could happen? Like, arms open kind of thing. And I love Kids in the Hall, like, so much. Dave Foley, love. Right. So it's like, again, it's like a kind of a holy grail moonshot sort of thing. And I just noticed that one day I noticed he'd interacted with a tweet of mine, and that was a while back. And then I was like, that's cool. And I got all weird about it. I was like, oh my God, that's so cool. And then one day I noticed he maybe liked something, and I was like, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to be that person who just slides into his DMs. And I unleashed the lamest, I mean, embarrassing eye roll of a like, hey, longtime listener, first time caller, pitch for him to come on my podcast. It was so loathsome and just like, girl, it was just embarrassing. But I guess it got his attention.
Right.
he just wrote back, sure, I'd love to come on. And I was like, oh, I wasn't prepared for that. So he's like, yeah, here's my cell. And I was like, oh, no, I was not prepared for that. And that all happened. Here's what's so insane. That happened on the Saturday night that the SNL thing happened. So in my phone, in my text messages is Dave Foley. And then I'm on SNL. And then the next thing I was like, oh, my name is Joanne Carducci. And then I said, well, you might have seen that on SNL. Ha, ha, ha. And then he was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, oh, right.
Yeah. So when you name drop something like that and they have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, that was so embarrassing. Worst. Yeah. But then he watched it, and then he wrote back and he was like, that's so cool. And then I was like, wait a minute. I have Dave Foley in my phone telling me that me being on SNL was cool. I think I have died again because you can't top that, really. I mean, unless Michelle Obama comes in and like gives you a high five, it's pretty much that's it. That's the highest I could get. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Kids in the Hall is all part of the SNL universe. I mean, that's part of the Lorne Michaels universe. Broadway Video produced Kids in the Hall. Broadway Video is run by Lorne Michaels. So you're like in this weird nexus of Saturday Night Live in between two legendary shows produced by Lorne Michaels. That's kind of incredible.
Well, you know what? It kind of brings a lot of my life full circle because Dan Aykroyd's kid, I forget which kid or what their name was, went to the same college as I did. And I was like, that Dan Aykroyd came to them. Yeah. So I was destiny, really, you know?
Yeah.
I went to a college that where comics go, and I majored in communications, politics, and law. So I feel like Emerson is like, dummy, this wasn't the right major. You were supposed to go into comedy, but we're going to remind you by putting you in comedy stuff, like when you're least expected in your adult life when you're just like a mom in the middle of the suburbs. So yeah, super weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like certain celebrities haven't discovered what the protocol is for podcasts now, where if you're a celebrity and you interact with someone who has a podcast, invariably you're in the snare, you're caught, you're in the trap. We're going to ask you if you'll be on our podcast. I do that all the time. It's like, yeah. Oh my God, someone, you know, it used to be when the blue checks actually meant something. Yeah. When I'd see a blue check remark on one of my tweets, I would go, okay, I've got that guy in the trap. I'm going to ask him to be on the podcast, but they haven't figured that out yet. So it's kind of like, yeah, we can still exploit that opening,
right,
and get some people on our show. So that's sort of what happened with Dave Foley.
Yeah exactly. And it's something I'm very late too, because I had that like imposter syndrome that so many people probably struggle with.
Oh,
where I was like,
same, yeah.
Right? And then you're like, I can't do that. Like, they won't, they're not going to like me and I'm not worth it. And then I was like, yeah. What the heck? Why the fuck not? Like, why not? You know, somebody years ago when I wasn't even working really, somebody said something like, "What? Why not me? Why not you? Why can't any of us have, you know, this kind of success? Why can't we? Just try for it and just put yourself out there." And so ever since then, I've been like, yeah, let's do it. Like, what are they going to say? No, and then call the cops on me? Like, she came into my DMs. She asked me to be on her podcast. I can't do it. Yeah. So, no, you're right. And I feel bad for anybody who likes my tweets now.
Yeah. Well, it's a no-brainer for you to do a podcast. I mean, like me, you're endowed with the gift of gab. So that's something you have to harness that in some way. And podcasting is a great way to do that.
Well, you're so better in many ways. You're much better at it. I mean, you certainly have a better voice. Your voice is like, I would dream to have such a try.
Thank you.
Yeah, you have a good voice for this stuff. I don't have it.
You have a great voice, but I have to ask you with regard to the episode of your podcast with Dave Foley. You talked about UFO sightings. What was generally the conclusion about the UFOs? Are they actual aliens? Is that something you agreed on, or was that something that was still a matter of debate?
Well, interestingly, I never expected that podcast to really take that turn for as significantly of it really became a UFO podcast. I think I have UAP, because look at me, I don't know.
Yeah.
I have like followers now who are in that community.
Wow.
Super cool for me. And I could easily see myself like, it's so hard for me not to text David, be like, hey, buddy, there's this thing in the desert that they do. And that sounds like a sacrifice, but it's not. It's like a UAP kind of event. And yes. I'm like, I so want to go to that because I could see myself sort of like becoming like, not like, you know, obsessed with it, but I could see myself kind of getting, you know, becoming a hobbyist, so to speak, because it was fascinating. Like the things that Dave told me about his experiences and the things that he knows. And then going back in time and remembering my own experiences with stuff that I, to this day, can't explain, that he's like, yeah, that sounds right. And the whole subject matter fascinates me. And he's become quite an authority on it, which is also interesting. But the stuff that he knows, and it sounds conspiratorial, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's not. Obviously, people believe this stuff. And there's all sorts of, you know, people out there who are experts in the field. The things that he knows and shared with me in the podcast about what our government knows were things that I wasn't really ready for. And so that was fascinating too. But I learned a lot, and I'm just piqued my interest even more than I already had an interest in it, and I've already believed in these things. But now that we're talking about them, Dave says that they know. So just keep an eye out. Yeah.
Okay.
They know.
All right. I will. Mm-hmm. The other thing that he was involved with recently that I found to be utterly amazing, I mean, a masterpiece, Fargo season 5, where he played one of the main characters in that anthology series. And one of the great things about that particular season is it was allegorical for what we're going through right now. Like, John Hamm played this sort of far-right MAGA militia guy, this rancher, sort of a Bundy kind of guy. And Jennifer Jason Leigh was kind of his nemesis. And Dave Foley played Jennifer Jason Leigh's sort of fixer, her lawyer fixer. And was so interesting, so entertaining in that. And there was a sequence in that particular series that kind of defined what we're talking about with regard to the MAGA movement, which is Jennifer Jason Leigh describes John Hamm's MAGA character as wanting to have freedom without responsibility, freedom to exist in this country, but no responsibility to the greater good through the social safety net or anything like that. And the way she defined it was, and this is a testament to the writers of that show, who are the only people who want freedom without responsibility? And the answer to that question is babies. So therefore, John Hamm was, in this series, fighting for the right to be a baby. And I thought that was so profound as a defining moment for this agenda that we're pushing back against perpetually. These people want freedom without responsibility. They want to be treated like a baby. Just an incredible way to put it. Yeah.
It really is. And it is, it matches up perfectly with what we're experiencing because, I mean, I've long since described Trump as being around Trump as being stuck inside the middle of like a 2-year-old's never ending tantrum. It's a perpetual tantrum of a toddler because, like you said, it's exactly that. And her comparison is perfect because they act like sort of, or Veruca Salt, if you want to even say, like, I want what I want, and I want it now, and I don't want to have to work for it, and I don't want to have to do anything to earn it, and I don't want to protect anybody else's right to it. I want it right now, and you can't have anything. And it does, like, it's very toddlerish, and it's, but that is a perfect comparison.
Yeah, it really, really is. But you know what? I want to talk about Super-ish Tuesday. Yesterday.
Yeah.
I noticed that Nikki Haley won the Vermont primary by 4 points, I think, even though every single poll forecasted Trump winning that primary by as much as like 30 points.
Yeah.
I think it was in the range of 20 to 30 points. So he also underperformed the polls in Minnesota and Virginia by at least 20 points as well. And yet he and his disciples are measuring the drapes in the White House already. Donald Trump said the other day, hey, look, we don't need any more votes. We've got enough votes. No more votes. I mean, he's actually saying that kind of crap out loud.
Yeah.
That's a recipe for disaster, isn't it?
Oh, 100%, because what you have then is Biden saying he doesn't want your votes. I do. Yeah. You know, that's fine. There's no room for you in his tent. He wasn't going to do anything for you anyway. I am. And it's just this spoiled, like, you can't sit with me anyway. Or it's like, I broke up with you first. It's like, so again, it goes back to this sort of immaturity, but it's just reactionary and emotional. And like, it's not leadership clearly, but yeah, go ahead. Tell the part of your party that voted for Haley and not you, that you don't want them anyway. That's going to go really well for you, and you're going to attract a whole lot of independents that way too. I'm sure they're going to be drawn to you like flies to the flame, right? Like, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you feel about moths? Same thing. Absolutely the same thing. But how do you peg the polls at this point? Because I know we're still susceptible. As much as we like to tell ourselves that the polls suck and they're janky and they're not representative of anything that's actually happening on the ground, they're basically there to fuel the horse race narrative on television. Because I know, like, the Bloomberg swing state polls dropped right before the weekend. I think it was sometime either Friday or early Saturday. And I got the sense that a lot of people saw those and were like, oh, shit, even though we know better than to believe the polls. But it's still kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, the polls have proven themselves to be so completely, inaccurate and detached from reality, as we saw in New York 3 as well. But the one thing that it does for us, which I think is important, unfortunately, is that we have to always remember that there is a real possibility here that this could go wrong, all sorts of wrong, and that there is, if Trump has a 50% shot, right, like, of being the president, which is, gives me chills to even say it. But if we ever kind of, you know, fall back and think, like, into some sense of complacency, like, we've got this, and we don't just keep pushing our foot constantly to the pedal and always pushing forward, then I think we leave ourselves open to vulnerabilities. I think the idea of thinking that this could be, you know, something we lose keeps us hungry, keeps us driven. We can't ever say that the polls are completely wrong all the time. Maybe they are indicative of trends that we're not noticing, and those are cracks and fissures that we need to address and can't miss. So the polls are usually wrong, yes, but there are some things in them that are takeaways, I think, that can be useful. And I also just think, really, that any idea that we've got this and we can chill and relax and it's you know, put it on autopilot is dangerous and will not yield the results we seek.
Yeah, that's such a great point of view on all of this. It would actually benefit us greatly if, on some level, we did take the polls seriously. Like, let us pretend that the polls are accurate, knowing that they're probably not. let's motivate ourselves behaving as though mm-hmm. we are 5 points down or whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm. I think that is a better position to be in. In fact, I'd much rather be an underdog right now than feeling complacent like the Republicans absolutely are. Yeah. And that will, I think, drive turnout. That'll drive energy because, I mean, that's what this election's going to require. It's not just about defeating Donald Trump again. It's going to be about maybe taking the Senate or holding on to the Senate in a difficult map.
Yeah.
And then also winning the House, some state legislatures, some governor's mansions along the way. It's one of those things where it's got to be an all-out effort. The energy has to be there. Otherwise, it's just we're going to get sort of half measures. We'll maybe secure the presidency again. But mm-hmm. if we lose some state legislatures or we lose the Senate, mm-hmm. then that causes trouble for judges. So yeah, I think that energy is important, isn't it?
Oh, 1,000%. And they're not stopping. You know what I mean? They're full court press on this shit. And they don't have anything to show for any of their tenure at the helm. But that doesn't really matter for them. But for some strange reason, their messaging kind of resonates better. I think for whatever reason, the grievance thing, it hits people better. It's more powerful. Like people, they say whatever bad, like a bad review travels further. And a lie makes its way around the world faster. Yeah. And that stuff is true because what we're seeing is this Trump is pushing this message of America sucks and everything is broken and no one's taking care of you and making up lies about, you know, oil drilling being lowest, which is not true, and jobs being lowest, which is obviously not true. But mm-hmm. but that message seems to be pervasive. And so it's not what's being accomplished by the Biden administration and the Democrats is not making it through. People are like, oh, but inflation is high and gas prices are still high. And we need to keep pushing these messages because we have to push through all that crap, right? Yeah. So we have to also push not only what's at stake, which is massive, right? In any scenario, if we lose the Senate, if we don't get the House back, if we lose the presidency, like the implications of what we have it to lose are massive and manyfold. Everything from public education to, you know, reproductive freedom to voting rights to deportation in history to job protections. I mean, this is another thing that's getting missed is that they're going to strip away protections that we have as American workers. They're going to strip away, the ability to earn overtime, and they're going to make these work weeks all screwy, and then environmental protections at work, all those things. So those are the things we have to lose. And I know I'm talking a lot, but this is the thing. You have to frame it also as what people will gain, because people are motivated by what they'll gain. And I think that that's something we have to really push too, because, codifying reproductive freedom and ensuring up voting rights and, you know, student debt relief. And these are the things that motivate people. These are the kitchen table issues that motivate people. And that's what we have to be saying. This is what you'll get, what you won't lose and what you'll get.
Yeah. And likewise, I feel like we've got to constantly triage the ridiculously short-term memories of American voters. And like going back to the results in Vermont from last night, I'm going to call it right here, Joe. Mm-hmm. If Trump becomes president again and there's an emergency in Vermont, he'll refuse to send federal aid. I mean, I think that's fait accompli.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like we need to remind everyone what it was like during Trump's one term, even though that final year was an endless nightmare for everyone, capping mm-hmm. off an endless nightmare 4 years.
Yeah.
I mean, is it possible to remind enough people that it'll make a difference in November? I mean, is this something that we can do?
Well, here's who I think we can move, actually. I think we can move those Republican voters who said in exit poll after exit poll that they could not see themselves voting for Donald Trump, regardless of whether or not he's convicted of any of these four indictments.
Yeah.
They just couldn't see themselves, you know, pulling the lever, so to speak, for him. They are reachable. 1,000%, they are reachable. And part of the reasons that they're not going to, even though they voted for Trump twice, that they can't do it again is not only what he's done in the years since he lost, and he lost, but it's what he did in the 4 years he had. This is a crucial thing, like you said. Like, people do forget, but they also forget. They forget COVID, and they forget that COVID didn't have to be as bad here as it was, if not for his grotesque mismanagement of this pandemic. I mean, this is a person who is basically shaming people for wearing masks and social distancing and being careful and cautious You think of all the lives we could have saved if we had a real leader at the helm, someone like, you know, Biden, who takes that, who was taking it seriously. Instead, you got Trump talking about disinfectants under the skin. And I mean, the doctors were using medical gear. The guy got COVID. He nearly killed Chris Christie with COVID. He nearly killed his own Secret Service with it. Like, it was so mismanaged that it was an even greater crisis than it could have, should have been, you know, and people do forget. Look, there, I don't know if you saw this, people forget what January 6th was, and that wasn't that long ago.
It's infuriating. I feel like we constantly have to run around, like, chasing people down and say, hey, wait, remember that thing? Mm-hmm. There was that thing from 4 years ago. Remember when they were burying people in mass graves? Remember that? Remember when we had to wipe our butts with coffee filters? You remember that? That was, Donald Trump was president at that time. And they're like, oh, I forgot.
Yeah.
I'm astonished that so many people have that that ability to be able to shut out something or just absolutely forget something that happened just a few years ago. I mean, it wasn't like ancient history. I mean, it was less than 4 years ago when COVID started. It's amazing.
Right. And it's so much of it is by design, because another thing, and I hate to give them credit for anything, but another thing they're good at is revisionist history. They're really good at being like that, repeating the lie often enough that people accept it as the truth. That's just like their mantra, sort of. And it works. Yeah. You know, it's effective. Yeah. And you'll notice Trump does it too all the time. He does it with the words that get the most like sensational headlines all of a sudden. Like he'll refer to immigrants as vermin, or he'll or his opponents as vermin, or he says, I'll be a dictator on day one. And it gets like, oh my God, did you hear what he said? And we all do the thing we're supposed to do because it's outrageous. And then he's like, oh, okay. So he knows, right? So that was the test balloon. So then he says it a couple more times. And then he starts weaving it into every single speech. And what does that do? It dumbs it down. It normalizes it. It becomes this thing that is no longer sensational. And then you don't even notice that this value of the things that he said is degraded to the point where you're not even paying attention to it anymore, because you're on to the next 15 crazy things. And that's what they've done with history. That's what they've done with the truth of the 2020 election. 60% of the voters in North Carolina said that they did not believe that Biden was legitimately elected. Elected in this
God
primary.
Damn,
Think about that. But that's this little thing that they, this thing that they do is every day they degrade the truth a little bit, so that you never notice. It's like democracy dies in imperceptible at first and then all at once, right? So they're just chewing away at the truth. And it's effective. And January 6th is the perfect example of that. Imagine, as we were watching it that day, imagine thinking you and I would be having a conversation 4 years later, where a whole huge swath of the country was going to see those people as hostages and patriots. Imagine then watching it, thinking that we'd have this conversation now, and here we are.
All right, short break. Back with more JoJo from Jurors after this.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
There is exciting news in Stephanie Miller podcast land, isn't there, Chris? We now offer Stephanie Miller's Happy Hour podcast and the Out of the Gate podcast.
Stephanie Miller's Happy Hour podcast is once a week. It is the best interviews of the week from the Stephanie Miller Show every Friday. Stephanie Miller Out of the Gate is daily. You will get the first segment of every day's Stephanie Miller Show, plus Stephanie Miller's Happy Hour Extra, which is the best interview of each day. So three different podcasts in one feed.
Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
Subscribe on your favorite podcast app.
Hi, it's Randy Rhodes, and here's what you missed. They're projecting on the front page of every newspaper, projecting on the TV every single day that Biden is old. He is old, but so is Donald Trump. And if they actually put the crap that he spews at these crazy rallies of his, as soon as he gets off the teleprompter, he goes completely south. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Did an interview yesterday with Fox. They asked him what he would do about inflation. He has no earthly idea. But if they put on the front page of the newspapers every single day that Donald Trump is spewing, garbage, that nothing he says makes sense, that he hasn't been able to find a sentence with a flashlight and thesaurus, hasn't been able to say one serious thing about one serious issue that makes any sort of a sentence out of that issue. And then you polled people and then you asked the question, you would get a completely different result. Don't have time to listen to the live show? Want to hear more on your schedule? Go to randyrhoads.com and buy a stinking podcast.
Bob Seska.
All-time favorites all day long.
One thing I wanted to mention, and this actually involves a little bit of math, so I'm going to try to navigate my way through this, but this is all, the end game is something very, very positive coming out of, strangely enough, North Carolina last night. Mm-hmm. Nikki Haley got 249,000 votes in North Carolina, coming up on 250,000 votes. According to a CBS News poll, about 78% of Nikki Haley voters are refusing to vote for Donald Trump in November. That's 176,790 voters, Republican voters, will refuse to vote for Donald Trump in North Carolina in November. At least that's what they're telling exit polls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing about that is Donald Trump in 2020 only won North Carolina by 74,000 votes.
Mm.
So if Democrats can really drive turnout in places like North Carolina, at the very least, that state's a toss-up. I don't care what the goddamn polls are saying. Turnout is going to drive everything. If Joe Biden and the Democrats can drive massive turnout in these kinds of swing states, given the fact that Donald Trump's actually hemorrhaging support from his own party, that's a massive positive. I think this can be done. I think this is actually a thing that's possible to win in places like North Carolina. What do you think?
I agree with you 1,000%. And I think the people on the ground in North Carolina are so fired up right now because Mark Robinson, by the way, their lieutenant governor, who's insane.
He is insane, yeah.
Right? They don't want him anywhere near the governor's mansion, right? With good reason. This is a Holocaust denier. This is a person who, I can't even think of all the ridiculousness of it, idolizes despots and dictators and, rails against abortion, even though he paid for one himself. He's a crazy person, but he's also very dangerous. And what he's done now to the electorate in North Carolina is he's lit them on fire. They are like, nope, we all got to get out. I'm pissed. There's this woman, Michelle Morrow, who's like just won a primary to be superintendent of education or something like that. She's also an extremist who's just batshit crazy. And North Carolina, it doesn't look like it's purplish at all. When you look at like some of the maps and you look at their legislature, maybe it wasn't Michelle Morrow. Maybe it was. I forget who it was. But there, it's very much in play. And when you get them worked up and fired up to stop these extremists, like that's what's happening right now, they're really going to turn out. And not only are they going to turn out, they're going to be having those conversations with their friends. They're going to be having get-togethers like they do. I don't know what they call them in North Carolina, barbecues. They're going to be having those conversations, and they're going to be like, y'all, okay, we don't like that. And so we got to fix it. And so I think that does bode well. But again, it's not something we can take for granted. We just got to keep hammering the messages again. What you stand to lose versus what you stand to gain. And people are looking at them. I think the majority of the American people, they don't want the crazy. They don't want the chaos. They don't want this Holocaust denier to be their governor.
Right, right. Yeah, and he's not just a Holocaust denier. He said gays are the end of civilization. He called school shooting victims prostitutes.
Oh, God, I can't even.
I think that's some sort of play on the word prostitute. He said shootings are karma for abortion. He called the civil rights movement a communist plot.
Mm.
So this is the guy, and I really hope that you're 1,000% correct, that in addition to Donald Trump, that this Republican candidate for North Carolina governor is going to drive all kinds of Democratic turnout to stop this MF-er from rising to that governor's mansion there. And so between these things, you know what? I probably shouldn't feel confident, but I strangely do. And, maybe I'll disabuse myself of this confidence at some point in the not too distant future.
No,
but
don't.
For now, I'm feeling okay. I mean, is it okay to feel confident about November, or should I be more panicked?
No. See, I think that confidence is crucial, right? Because confidence is inspiring, and it makes you feel like you're going in the right direction. Panic is bad. Not bad. I don't want to use that word bad, but it is
counterproductive.
Counterproductive can be demoralizing and irreflective of reality, and can also just make you just not want to do anything. So we shouldn't do that. But confidence is good, and I'll meet you there, because I believe in the power of the American people. I believe in our will. I believe in our resilience. I believe in this little experiment, and I believe at the end of the day, as we've seen in all of the ballot measures in state after state after state on the issue of abortion, that we are the majority. That more Americans, like I said before, that more Americans are really here in these reasonable places that don't occupy the extremes. We really just want our kids to be safe. We want our neighborhoods to be safe. We want people to be protected and have a pathway to citizenship. You know, we want fewer guns. We want no school shootings. I mean, we can agree on some fundamental things. These, again, I go back to that kitchen table issue, but it's true. And I think we, the people, have to be motivated to understanding what's at stake, because that's a driver. I mean, I know you know. People are like, I'm not really motivated to vote for either one of these two because they're old and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Well, you got to get over that, because democracy is a daily practice, and we all were reminded of that when we lost our, you know, White House to a madman who then tried to steal our White House with violence. So we can't sit back, and we just have to get people to that place where they understand that their civic duty is being called upon, and will be called upon every day from now until, well, I guess eternity.
Well, you know, I feel like Nikki Haley left the door open for an eventual endorsement, even though she's not welcome in Trump's Republican Party. I mean, they've made that clear. Mm-hmm. So what the hell is her reasoning here? I mean, why on earth would she eventually join the conga line of groveling before Donald Trump? I mean, we saw that with Ted Cruz in 2016. So I think it's a safe bet that Nikki Haley will eventually endorse Donald Trump. Probably, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's going to be at the convention, where she will pledge whatever couple of delegates that she has to Donald Trump at that point in time,
right.
To unify the party, perhaps. I mean, you know, but again, it's another Republican like Mitch McConnell today. Couldn't wait to grovel before Donald Trump. And I can't figure out what the hell is going on over there with those people and this weird, twisted, abusive relationship they have with Donald Trump. What the hell is going on, Joe?
Well, let's start with Nikki Haley. I call her a flip-flopping former guy fawning weathercock, because that's...
I love that. Yeah.
And then sometimes I'll just shorten it to the weathercockiest weathercock, because there's a lot of weathercocks out there. It's a deep bench.
Yeah.
It's a deep bench.
Deep bench of weathercocks.
It is a deep bench of weathercocks, which is a MILF porn that Ted Cruz liked on his phone. But deep bench of weathercocks. But yeah, no, Nikki really is such, we all know. I mean, how many times has she flip-flopped on Trump, right? Like back in 2016, she and Marco were both against him, and she said, he's everything I don't want my children to be. And then she was, you know, in his administration. And she flip-flopped on him after January 6th, too. And here she's flip-flopping again. It's what she does, because she has no spine. Like, none of them have spines. I mean, they all had them removed by probably aliens. But that's bringing it back to Dave. But yeah, no, she's so feckless and craven, and just like Ted and Marco. And the calculus, I guess, for these people, and I want to explain a little bit. Also, the calculus is that they think that this is going to eventually be beneficial to them, and I think they're running out of rope there. But her today, if you listen to what she said, and it was, it seems so reasonable. You know, she didn't want to endorse him. She left the door open. And listen to what she said, okay? Like, she wants him to earn her voters, right? To earn the party's voters, the people who supported her. Now, this is the same person who very recently said that he's unfit to serve, that he is mentally unstable, that we shouldn't have to worry about the mental fitness of our leaders. And that she's talking about someone, you can't reform that. Trump, even if he could go out and talk real nice every day and say real good things about people, he couldn't reform what she's saying is fundamentally flawed. So she's already contradicting herself, even by saying he can earn that trust, he can earn those votes. She's already shown us what she thinks, which is that she's paving the pathway for an eventual, like you said, endorsement. She just thinks we're all stupid, and she can slide her way in there by looking like she's taking the high road and being reasonable and doing what's best for America.
Yep.
And it's bullshit. Mm-hmm. As for McConnell, that's a whole nother question because, man, oh, man. As Rick Wilson wrote today, it doesn't make much sense because there's literally nothing in the realm of reason that drives an endorsement of Trump for him, aside from wanting his grave to reek of ammonia, which is true. Like, I mean, can we just talk a minute?
From all the peeing is what you're saying,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I wouldn't waste my piss on his grave. Let's be real here, okay? I mean, at least my piss probably came from good wine or something. I don't know. I wouldn't waste it on that fucker's grave. But Rick's right. Like, what? Why? Why would the evil turtle do that? Like, Trump called his wife bigoted slurs repeatedly all the time. Like, all the time. I don't know. I mean, imagine if somebody said that shit about Kimberly. Like, what? Would you be like, you know what? I don't remember that. Or would you be like, I'm going to fucking kill that guy, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, when someone's mean to Kimberly in her replies on Twitter, that's like, okay, fuck that guy, I'm blocking
him.
Right. It's like,
God forbid
Donald
she makes
Trump
an
publicly,
Animal House reference. That was amazing. That was so amazing. Yeah. It's a fucking
I was so game. Disillusioned after that. I was like, sorry. Oh my God, I need to show some people some movies. Anyone got a VCR? It's absolutely insane. Animal House. It's an Animal House. I mean, even if you haven't seen Animal House, you know the Germans bombing Pearl Harbor thing. I mean, that's just, it's a meme. It's a gif, for God's sake.
Right, exactly.
But anyway, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know what? Same thing happened to Ted Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump went after Ted Cruz's wife.
Yeah.
He went after Ted Cruz's dad, said Ted Cruz's dad actually aided in the assassination of JFK.
Right.
And then Ted Cruz just couldn't wait to genuflect in front of Donald Trump. It's just unbelievable. And what it makes me think, Joe, is that one of the things that maybe Donald Trump was doing with all those classified documents is in and amongst them, possibly while he was president, this is before he took all that crap to Mar-a-Lago, that he was going through FBI files and saying, okay, I've got this on Lindsey Graham. Okay, I'm going to write that down, and let's see. Let's go down the enemies list a couple more notches. Oh, yeah, I'm going to get this this information on Mitch McConnell and Mitch McConnell's family, and then go on down. And so he's basically, Donald Trump, I mean, his admiration for Vladimir Putin is obvious, but I think it also extends to his choices in terms of compromat. Like, okay, I'm going to get compromat on all these people, friends and enemies alike. I'm going to use, does anyone believe for a second that Donald Trump is exercising restraint in the White House and say, oh, no, that's a bridge too far. I'm not going to look at anyone's FBI files. Of course he's looking at that shit, isn't he?
Oh, 1,000%. And this compromat thing, I mean, you could honestly make a really strong, compelling case for this sort of being the source of just the origin story of Trump, like in this whole run for president. And then let's just say that first trip he took with Ivana, that, you know, I don't know who peed on him. I don't know what happened, man. Something happened. Somebody did something with urine and poop. I don't know. Yeah. I just, maybe not. Or maybe she was, maybe this was a long play. I mean, I don't know. That sounds conspiratorial too. But the thing is, Republicans keep telling us, that there is this undercurrent of compromat. Like Tim Burchett, who I would hardly call a rhino, right? Like he used to be cosplay Wolverine or Dollar Store Wolverine until he shaved that shit off. Now he just looks like a weirdo. But no offense. I mean, there's a reason Ted Cruz has jowl merkins, and it's not like kind of take away from the phallus proboscis on his face. And Tim Burchett doesn't get the memo, but he said that all these Russian hookers, right, who trick all these Republicans with cocaine and stuff, and then all of a sudden they change their votes. He said that last year.
Wow.
Madison Cawthorn. I mean, he talked about coke sex orgies, and he had a honeypot of a wife, they say. I'm just saying that they're saying this stuff out loud, and it's the playbook, right? It's the playbook kind of now, because this is a party where you're like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would Lindsey Graham vote against aid for Ukraine? Because all he ever did was support Ukraine and stand up to Putin, and now he's doing Putin's bidding. Why? You know, why? And that's something that you have to be like, there has to be a threat there. And Trump also comes from that mobster world, too. You got to have something on people. And some of these people, to flip the way they flip, not that I'm giving Lindsey credit for anything, because he really is a pilot fish, But the way, the extreme way that he's flipped on some of this stuff and in these issues, you have to say there's got to be something. I mean, with him,
I don't even want to know what it is.
I know. There's a whole, oh my God, the dark sort of singularity of awfulness that's probably lurking in Lindsey Graham's FBI file.
Right.
I mean, John McCain's body wasn't even cold, and Lindsey Graham was like dropping to his knees in front of Donald Trump. It was an amazing thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, on a separate topic, Joe, I'm on the edge of my seat right now for a bunch of reasons, but some of them good, some of them bad. But on the good side, it feels like Letitia James is going to seize Trump's properties any day now. Mm. I feel like that's on his, do you feel like that's on the horizon? And do you also feel as though Donald Trump is stressing out over this? Is he affected by this this kind of anvil hanging over his head with his, you know, the civil fraud penalty and the interest accruing on that and the possibility that, yeah, Letitia James could very easily seize like 60 Wall Street and Trump Tower and all these other properties if she needs to?
I mean, what she's shown so far is that she has no fucks, right? She gives no fucks. Like, she's ready to hold him and has held him accountable. And I love when she was posting his interest, by the way. That was pretty amazing. I was like, please
wonderful.
Do this every day. Please do this every day. And yeah, so she's not fucking around. Like, this is money that she is owed. And E. Jean Carroll is also owed money. And they are coming for their money. And Letitia can do what she wants to do, what she needs to do. And it strikes right at the core of what I really call the big lie about Trump. It's the man behind the curtain, right? Like, you know, the wizard is not a wizard. He's not a self-made billionaire. He doesn't have as much money as he wants the world to believe. It's like this house of cards is built on this one great big lie about him. He's a fraud, right? So it, I'm sure, hangs over him like quite the anvil, because he knows on this lie all the other lies rely. And that was a poem that I wrote yesterday. And but when this one is exposed, when he's like, he can't make these payments because he's like, let's just give you $100 million and call it a day. And it's like, that's not how this works. They're not plumbers.
Yeah, that was hilarious. He was like treating the court like it was one of his subcontractors.
That he's not ever, they never even paid, right?
So yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, I'll give you 25 cents on the dollar if you go away. No, that's not how it operates here. No.
It's like Little House on the Prairie bartering with the dock. Like, I have these eggs and this ceramic elephant and a leprechaun hat that I will give you, and a cooler. I have an igloo cooler. It's vintage igloo cooler. It's like,
and a leprechaun hat. Holy shit.
I was just brick around my house. I was looking. I was like, what do I have? I have these things in my house.
Do you love lamp, Joe?
I love lamp. Brick, so, Joe, are you just saying things you see in the room right now? Yes. Yes.
So, I mean, after the Supreme Court decision on the 14th Amendment, what's your confidence level on the immunity issue? Should we be concerned about that at all? I mean, I'm not super concerned, but, you know, there's some people who are like, oh, shit, well, he's going to get immunity out of these people.
I will put nothing past them. I'll just say that. But, I mean, this one, the 14th, we were hearing pretty much everybody. You listened to oral arguments. You were like, this is not going well. They were right, sit down, son. Like, no, because are you serious right now with this? And it didn't sound well. None of us had a lot of expectation for it. I'll tell you what, the timeline of that is very indicative of how corrupt this court is and how they're putting not just their finger on the scale, I like to call it. They took Ginny Thomas and a bus of J6ers she paid for and put that on the scale in Trump's favor, because that timeline of the way that they ruled on the 14th was obviously suspicious, because it was, oh my God, look how quickly we can do something all of a sudden. And the fact that they put their finger on the scale of the timeline for the immunity case in the way that they did is also so corrupt. But if they go with this crazy idea that he is immune, I mean, then we're just going to, which is insane. No one thinks that they will. But then we're going to kind of have to go, we need to go rogue a little bit here. And like, Joe Biden, it's like, I don't know here, buddy. Apparently you're immune. So,
yeah.
I mean, maybe if we think outside the box right now, like, I think you just, I don't know, with all options on the table, because we can't have the guy who thinks he can shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and get away with it walking around shooting people in the middle of Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know what? And this is just me. This is sometimes the dark place I go to, the bleak far reaches of my subconscious. I feel like if Donald Trump doesn't get immunity and ends up winning the election, Oh, then he's absolutely never leaving office.
Because
he'd be terrified of getting prosecuted again.
Yep.
So there's that other downside. But of course, there's no possible way. I would be so immensely shocked if this court grants him presidential immunity in any way, shape, or form. They may reiterate some sort of carve out for official duties.
Yeah.
But this is just not going to happen. I can't see any circumstance that they would say, okay, you know what? We're going to endanger our own jobs now.
Yeah.
We're going to actually give the president some power to, you know, if he wants to blow up the Supreme Court building. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah, it just seems like it would be madness and suicidal, wouldn't it?
Well, and also, unfortunately, thanks to the way that things have gone, they are our political body. I mean, they are. They weren't supposed to be, but they are, and they make political calculations. And if they made that ruling, I mean, they know that all of their legitimacy, any shred of it that remains, would forever be gone. Mm-hmm. And then they really do present this threat to their existence, where it's like the same sort of institutionalists who are sitting on their hands right now going, I don't want to hold them accountable. We don't have the votes. They'll be like, okay, we have to do something because they have gone so rogue that we need to intervene before everything falls off the side of a cliff. Yeah. So I don't think that they would make such a ridiculously baseless ruling for that reason too. But I just don't put anything past them ever. But it does really remind us though that they have oversight that we're not utilizing and they need to have more oversight. I mean, Clarence Thomas should be recused from all of these cases. The fact that he got to rule on the 14th case on its face is wrong because it was an insurrection related to an event that his wife is implicated in. And that should, if you don't recuse for that, then what do you, you know, but he's also taking mortgage payments and fancy trips, just like Alito. So I think I don't put anything past them. But I think when we get to the other side of this, and that's also crucial in making the argument for why we need to keep the Senate and hold the House and expand our leads in both, I don't know, we're not going to have Manchin and Sinema to hold us back, that we need to actually start implementing the oversight on the Supreme Court. And we need to start impeachments, I think, on Alito and Thomas, who probably resigned before then anyway, because they'll know it's coming. But I just think that's a good reminder for why we need to fight for those other, to the House and the Senate, as well as the White House.
So are you spending most of your time on Twitter as far as social media still there? Are you kind of expanding to other places? Like what's your kind of home base where you hang out most? I'm still on Twitter most of the time, contrary to, I think, my own values. I'm still there somehow, but it seems like it's still kind of the hub, isn't it?
I would say that, unfortunately, I would say that that's true. You feel like, you kind of feel like you're like in the, bad boys club. You're like getting tattoos and like smoking joints. And it's like, that's right. I'm fucking here. I'm still here. Turn off the lights, bitch. Make me
it
a sandwich.
Sucks, but I'm here. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. I feel dirty as fuck right now, but that's, you know what? This is satisfying in the strangest ways. But it's my hub. I think I've always said it'll be my hub until they literally turn the lights off, whatever that looks like. But, I've actually sort of started relying less on social media platforms specifically. And honestly, my baby, the place that I'm the happiest, like this is Substack. It's I like the community over there. I like the kind of expression I can have in longer form. It's where I want to be all the time. And they have like their own little mini kind of like Twitter capacity they call notes. I don't know. It just makes me gleefully happy to be over there. And you can get rid of trolls like that. And there's not even that many of them. So that's my happy, happy place. But when I want to get dirty, you know, those days, I'm rolling in on Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you compare Substack versus Patreon? Because I know you've got a presence in both places. And they're kind of similar. I mean, there's kind of a Venn diagram overlap between the two of them, but which do you prefer? It sounds like Substack.
Well, it's interesting because they're different. I've always approached it this way. Patreon for me is more personal. Those are, I have Zooms with people who subscribe over there that we talk about my kids, like it's just their kids, their lives. It's just more personal. I don't show a lot of that stuff on social media. I've learned not to over the years. People have said horrible things about my kids that are like honestly abominable and like just disgusting. So I don't do that over there. But Substack is also again, it's like I just feel like there's this longer form capacity. I write these essays and newsletters, and people are spending the time. These are 10-minute reads in some cases, and they're spending the time to read them and then think about them and comment on them. And then there's whole dialogues between the people who are doing that. And so I'd say for me anyway, that's the differences between the two. And I have crossover where people are on both. But I just, yeah, I'd say Substack also has a podcasting component, which you can take advantage of and stuff. I don't work for Substack, I swear to God. I love it.
And so I think
in that form, there's also starting to be an emergent sort of dialogue between accounts, like between the people who are sharing content. Like there are conversations between like a Rachel Vindman and myself, or a, you know, Reed Galen and myself, or we Reed and Rachel. And, you know, there's this sort of new community emerging in that way too, which is really fascinating because it's still kind of a baby.
Yeah, yeah. I'm seeing a lot of movement towards Substack as being sort of a central hub for everyone's stuff. It's sort of this weird dynamic where there was maybe 15 years ago, there was this sort of scattered blogosphere, then everything consolidated, and now everything's blowing up again where everyone's sort of got their own personal platform. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like that. I kind of think that's better.
Is that, and I'll just say this too. This is currently happening with Twitter sort of and undermining the truth all the time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Reporters and journalists and like vetted stories and vetted truths, like, you know, Elon's posting lies about Joe Biden and migrants and stuff. And it's also interesting that they're happening at the same time because people are really seeking, they're really hungry for facts.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So how can people find your podcast? How can people find your Substack, et cetera, Joe?
Oh, well, they're of the same name, so that is helpful. They are both, are you effing kidding me? F little N-G, not the E, F, and my phone always makes it effing with an E. But I find that I say that a lot. Like, I it's funny, because I named it that, and I was like, you know, I do really say that a lot. Are you effing kidding me? I don't even say effing, I always say fucking. But like, yeah, so the Substack and the podcast are of the same name, Are You Effing Kidding Me? And then I'm still rolling on Twitter. I'm over there on Instagram. And Meta, I don't know what's happening with Meta, saying they're going to deboost political content.
Fuck that. God damn it. Yeah.
Not a fan of that. So, and then I have Patreon at JoJo from Jurors and stuff like that. And I feel like I could talk to you all day.
yeah, definitely. And I'll put a link in the description under this episode of BobSesca.com so people can find all of your things with just a couple of clicks.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Joe. It was great talking to you again today. And I can't wait to do this again.
Okay.
All right. We'll talk to you again real soon.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.